This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our first guests, Joel and Ethan Coen, wrote and directed the new film Inside Llewyn Davis. The Coen brothers also wrote and directed Fargo, The Big Lebowski, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, No Country for Old Men, A Serious Man, and True Grit. They spoke with Terry last Tuesday. Inside Llewyn Davis won the Grand Jury Prize at this year's Cannes Film Festival, and it's nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Motion Picture Musical or Comedy, and an Independent Spirit Award for Best Feature. Set in 1961, Inside Llewyn Davis stars Oscar Isaac in the title role, as a folk singer in Greenwich Village just before Bob Dylan comes on the scene. Llewyn Davis is known in the clubs, but isn't particularly successful. He used to be half of a folk singing duo, but his partner recently committed suicide. The solo album Davis subsequently recorded didn't sell. He's broke and sleeps on the couches of friends, who are losing their patience with him for good reason. He has a way of sabotaging friendships as well as professional opportunities. In one scene, Davis listens back to a track from the album of duets he made before his partner's death. Here's that track, with Marcus Mumford singing the role of the late partner.
If I had wings like Noah's dove, I'd fly the river to the one I love. Oh, fare thee well, my honey, fare thee well. Well, I had a man long and tall, he moved his body like a cannonball. Oh, fare thee well, my honey, fare thee well. I remember one evening.
Ethan Coen, Joel Coen, welcome back to Fresh Air. Why did you want to make a film about a folk musician in 1961?
Well,
sorry I asked.
Why did we? We had a very early thought. I mean, early meaning well before we ever wrote the script, so a number of years ago, where we thought, supposing Dave Van Rock gets beat up outside of Gertie's Folk City in the Village in 1961. That's the beginning of a movie. And we thought, okay, yeah, that's, why would that happen? And we couldn't really figure out why that would happen. Who would beat up a folk singer is sort of the problem. So we put that thought away and came back to it periodically over the next couple of years and eventually worked it out.
Dave Van Rock, for those who don't know, and probably most don't know, is a folk singer. He's kind of the biggest person on the scene in 1961 in the folk revival in Greenwich Village. Biggest person on the scene until Bob Dylan showed up. But sort of in our mind, he was the, kind of in quotes, the generic folk singer until we kind of figured out who the main character of the movie actually was and who actually was beating him up and for what reason.
In the movie, there's... Llewyn Davis is broke, and he's made his first solo album, and he's hoping, like, he doesn't even have money for a winter coat, so he's hoping he can collect some royalties on the solo album that he made. So there's a scene where he goes to the head of the record label he's recorded for, and this guy's also managing him, and it's this, like, elderly man who's very, like, old showbiz, old record industry. And he's there with his with an older woman who's his longtime secretary. And they kind of bicker like an old married couple. So Llewyn Davis goes there to try to collect some money. And you can tell that the head of the record company has absolutely, like, no feeling for Llewyn Davis's music. I want to play this scene where he goes in. And again, Llewyn Davis is played by Oscar Isaac. The head of the record label, Mel Novikoff, is played by Jerry Grayson. And his secretary is played by Sylvia Quarters. Llewyn Davis speaks first.
How we doing?
We're doing great.
Really? New record's doing well?
How we doing? Not so hot, I gotta be honest. Ginny, where's Cincinnati?
What?
Cincinnati, it's not in here.
It should be in there.
It's not in here, I'm telling you. Is it?
Cincinnati?
Yeah.
I got it.
What?
I got it.
You got Cincinnati?
Yeah, you want it?
Could I have it?
Should I bring it in?
Yeah.
Do you owe me something? You have to owe me something.
I wish. People need time, you know, get to know you, buy you as a solo act, even know you're a solo act. Cincinnati is not good.
That's it, right?
Yeah, this is it. God help.
Nobody knew us when we were a duo. It's not like me and Mike were ever a big act. It's not a big re-education for the public. Mel?
How you doing, kid?
Boy, well, that sounds really good.
Isn't
on the radio.
Really good?
It should be a radio play. It needs like a few cheesy effects to make it a radio play. You know, a creaky door or something.
I love the that way good. The agent and his secretary just keep repeating what each other said.
Uh-huh.
So is that exactly how you wrote it?
Yeah, pretty much.
So, did you know early in your career old showbiz agents like this guy?
No, we didn't. But actually, we did know from, well, I guess this is early in our career, when we used to work in the Brill Building, 1619 Broadway, which was Tin Pan Alley, exactly where these guys used to work from. And it was also a lot of cutting rooms in that building. And there were a lot of, not a lot, but there were a few old-timers still there when we were working in the Brill Building, and we would see them occasionally.
Yeah, so they had the pebble glass doors with the name of the company stenciled on the outside. I remember Johnny Marks Music was on the same hall we were on, our cutting room.
And he'd be a guy who, in that case, I think he had like one song, like Peter Cottontail, that he sat in there. He's about 90 years old, and he would wait for the phone to ring in case anyone wanted to license it.
And so you had your editing room in the Brill Building?
Yeah, there were a lot of cutting rooms there. Actually, until quite recently, the last kind of movie post-production company just moved out recently.
I want to play another scene for you. And this is a scene. Llewyn Davis has been, he spent one night crashing at the home of a university professor who he knows. When he leaves in the morning, the couple who he's crashing with have already left. And when he leaves in the morning, the cat runs out the door of the apartment, and then the door slams behind him. So he's locked out, and meanwhile, the cat's running away, so he grabs the cat. And then the cat runs away from him, and then he finds the cat and returns the cat to the apartment. And so this is when he returns the cat to the apartment, and Mr. Gorfein, the university professor, opens the door, and there's a couple of friends at the apartment, too.
Oh, there's the cat.
Yeah.
Home from the hill. Hey, Llewyn, welcome. Come on in. Lillian's in the kitchen. She's making her famous moussaka.
No, I can't barge in for dinner. Well, I just wanted to...
Oh, no, come on. No. One more person?
No, I can't...
Moussaka? Come on. Do you know Marty Green and Janet Fung?
Hello, nice to meet you, Llewyn Davis.
Oh, Mitch and Lillian's folk song friend.
You crashing with us?
Oh, no. I hadn't even planned on dinner.
Llewyn's not an Upper West Side guy. We only get to see him when
I've rotated through my village friends.
Yeah, we're the last resort. Marty's in my department. And Joe's a musician. This is Joe Flom. He plays in Music at Antica with Lillian.
Oh. Oh, how you doing?
Nice to meet you.
Yes. What's your instrument?
Well, anything with a keyboard. I play celeste and harpsichord in M.A. I'm a piano instructor most days.
All right, want to take a bit?
Oh, sure.
A glass of wine, Llewyn? Little Diggle Red?
Yeah. I should have brought something.
Well, hey, don't be silly. You brought the cat.
Right. You know, I used to take piano lessons when I was a kid from Mrs. Siegelstein. You don't know Mrs. Siegelstein, do you? Very, very big calves, orthopedic shoes. Lives in Far Rockaway upstairs from the Carlins.
Does she play early music?
Harry James on the radio. On the piano, Drink to Me Only with Thine Eyes.
Uh-huh.
She was not a swinger.
Well, Harry James.
Okay, yeah, well, her playing, though, was pretty on the beat.
It's a scene that from Inside Llewyn Davis. Doesn't work so well, you think?
It doesn't work as well as a radio play. I must say, you need the picture. You need the full horror of a little social conclave on the Jewish academic Upper West Side. Yeah, it kind of loses something there.
Well,
but, okay.
Your parents were both, or are still both, university professors. Do you feel like you knew the Gorfines when you were growing up?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Tell us about the people you knew who you based it on, without mentioning names, of
now
course.
Now you're trying to get me in trouble.
No, you know, you know, it's a world we know. Our parents were both academics in the Midwest, in our case, not on the Upper West Side. But, you know, academia is probably pretty similar everywhere.
Well, I like the way they provide the couch for Llewyn to sleep on, but Llewyn gives them, like, authenticity and, like, folk music credibility. He's their folk music friend.
Right. Maybe he, right. He keeps them feeling young. Yes. He's their young friend.
And their hip friend.
Right.
And I also like the way what they're serving is moussaka. I know people still eat moussaka, but moussaka was just like, it was one of these like ethnic dishes that was particularly popular in the 60s, I think.
Yeah.
Popular
new
in the 60s.
To a lot of people.
Right, it was exotic, but right, exactly. Later in the movie, he comes back and she's made her a tabbouleh salad.
Yeah, exactly. And he even has to pronounce it with a certain like ethnic flair, like with her moussaka.
Well, yes, that actually was a hallmark of my mother's cooking, too. She was, you know, an incredibly interesting, talented woman, but not a cook. She didn't really know how to do it, but she gave everything a try.
Now, something we couldn't see on the radio is that in the Gorfines' apartment is a very, like, artistic menorah. It's like a menorah where it's a little, like, abstracted. And
actually, there are several menorahs there. You could do a kind of Where's Waldo's thing, looking for the menorahs in that Gorfines' apartment.
That's true. Actually, I think when we were cutting the movie at one point, I pointed out to you, I said, I think there are three menorahs in this one shot.
And are any of those
but
from,
yeah,
like,
those
family collections
designs.
Or anything? Yes, exactly.
No, something we're very, also very familiar with, you know, something that we made more hay out of, perhaps, than A Serious Man. But we were into that whole 60s modernist Judaica aesthetic.
Right. And as I think everyone could tell from that scene, the main character, Llewyn Davis, just really has a talent for irritating people. He knows exactly how to do it.
Yeah, no, definitely. He's his own worst enemy, and he gets into trouble with people and probably realizes immediately after saying the wrong thing that he's said the wrong thing and probably feels bad about it. But then, you know, 10 minutes later, he'll say the wrong thing again.
So it's interesting. In some ways, I think of this as like your second musical, you know, the first being Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? Do you think of Inside Llewyn Davis as a musical, but, you know, in a different kind of musical?
In a way, yeah.
Okay. There's a lot of music in it. Is that the standard? It's not a musical, certainly in the sense that we've never done one in this sense, that the characters kind of unmotivatedly break into song. I mean, it's music about a professional musician or somebody who's aspiring to be a professional musician. So it's all in a kind of a real context. But yes, in terms of the amount of music, okay, we'll call it a musical.
And do you like musicals at all?
Well, yeah, sure.
you're talking about Broadway musicals.
No, and movie musicals.
We're talking about movie musicals.
Yeah, that would include like Busby Berkeley and Fred Astaire. And
oh,
then
yeah.
Broadway
oh, yeah,
absolutely. Includes Stephen Sondheim. I mean,
yes.
Like the whole
yeah,
gamut.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But Busby Berkeley is, you know, a radical sort of and very, very interesting film artist. And those movies are fantastically interesting.
You didn't think about that at all when making your, quote, musicals?
Well, no, we didn't, but we've thought about them in the context of other musical numbers and movies that we've done, specifically in The Big Lebowski.
Yeah, we did one thing in The Big Lebowski that was kind of, yeah, very consciously, self-consciously, a Busby Berkeley number.
Wait, refresh my memory.
Jeff Bridges, the Jeff Bridges character, is Oh, my God. I'm going to try to synopsize it, and it'll sound demented. He's doped by a pornographer played by Ben Gazzara, and when he's in a, you know, heightened state, he has a dream about this woman played by Julianne Moore in which bowling figures, and it's a Busby Berkeley musical number.
He goes under the legs of these sort of Koreans on a bowling alley, and it's all to a Kenny Rogers tune called I Just Dropped In to See What Condition My Condition Is In.
Oh, okay. You know, I saw The Big Lebowski again when it was released, like, one night only in movie theaters, like, 2 summers ago, maybe.
Uh-huh.
It's just amazing how, what a huge following that film got in its afterlife. You know, like, after it closed in movie theaters. How did that happen?
Yeah.
It's a great film, but, I mean, how did it develop that afterlife? Do you have any idea?
Well, it developed the afterlife on home video. You're right. It came out in movie theaters. It didn't do, you know, particularly outstanding business in the theatrical market, but it did in the home video market.
Yeah.
And then it became sort of, you know, some cult thing. I don't know. How do you explain that? I have no idea. It's certainly one of the more bizarre afterlives to any of the things that we've done.
Mm-hmm.
We were in a movie theater together with our families a year or two ago in San Francisco, and coming down from a movie, and we saw there was a little booth set up with Big Lebowski posters on it, and a young woman sitting on the other side of this table, maybe 17 or 18 years old, and Ethan stopped and said, "What is this?" And she said, "Oh, well, we show The Big Lebowski every night, and people come dressed up in costumes, and you should come. You'll like it. It's fun."
Did she know who you were?
No.
That's great. Who would you come dressed as?
We stay away from those things.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. In your previous movie, True Grit, you had to direct a lot of horses in really tough scenes to direct, and you had to really, of course, be very careful in how you treated the horses. In your new movie, the tough animal scenes have to do with a cat or a couple of cats. So how do you cast a cat for your film?
Ooh, that was horrible. We just used, on the advice of the cat trainer, the animal trainer, kind of orange, kind of a marmalade tabby cat, just because they're, you know, common, so easy to double, triple, quadruple. There were, you know, many cats playing the one cat. And, you know, the whole thing is actually pretty, it comes across well in the movie, but the whole exercise of shooting a cat is pretty nightmarish because they don't care about anything. They don't want to do what you want them to do. As the animal trainer said to us, a dog wants to please you, a cat only wants to please itself. It was just long, painstaking, frustrating days shooting the cat.
What you have to do is basically find the cat that's predisposed to doing whatever particular piece of action it is that you have to film. So you find the cat that isn't afraid to run down a fire escape, or this, you know, the cat that's very docile and will let the actor just hold them for extended periods of time without being fidgety. And then you want the fidgety cat and the squirrely cat for when you want the cat to run away. And you just keep swapping them out depending on what the task at hand is.
You know, in True Grit, we had a vulture, a trained vulture, which who knew there were such. But, you know, that was a pain. And it was even, like, you know, by vulture standards, probably a stupid vulture. And that was frustrating. But, you know, I would take a vulture over a cat. The cat was just horrible.
So both O Brother, Where Art Thou and Inside Llewyn Davis refer in some way to Ulysses or the Odyssey. Did you read that? Did that make a big impact on you, or is it just kind of coincidental?
We haven't read it yet.
It's pre-influenced.
It's on our list. It's on our list.
We've made two movie versions of it, and we're going to read it soon.
Yeah. It's right at my bedside table, and I keep looking over at it and going, ugh.
I hear it's a good book.
But you are doing a film, I understand. Your next film is going to be set in ancient Rome. Is that true?
Well, part of it is set in ancient Rome.
Can you tell us anything about the forthcoming movie?
Well, we don't
know that it actually is going to be the next movie. You know, we're in the middle of writing the script, and quite honestly, I mean, you know, we often start these things, get a certain distance with them, and then put them aside for a while. They generally get finished eventually and even made eventually, but not necessarily without sort of digressions into other projects.
It's not really ancient Rome. In 1950 Hollywood, and they're making a movie about ancient Rome. So, if you know, for what it's worth, movie I'm talking about.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's about a movie that's being made in 1950 about ancient Rome called Hail Caesar.
Oh, that's great. So, since you're writing a movie together now, can I ask you a little bit about what the writing process is when you write a movie together? Do you write in the same room together? Do you share ideas after you've written separately?
It's mostly napping.
We go to the office, you know, we're there, we're in a room together. We take naps, but, you know, the important thing, we're there at the office should we be inspired to actually write something. No, we don't split it up. We don't sort of, one of us won't write something and then give it to the other to react to. We actually kind of talk through whatever we're doing together.
Do you do the dialogue out loud with each other as if you were characters?
Well, sometimes, but it doesn't exactly work like that. It's more... You know, there's so much talking involved. There's so much conversation involved around the whole thing. And a lot of the conversation has to do with specific things that people say in a scene, right? And that may be in the context of talking about something completely different from the dialogue. But then that comes up, and then one of us may say something about that, and then the other person may just sort of answer it with what might come next. But it's also the case that frequently, Ethan will just sit down, or I'll sit down and at the computer and just type up dialogue in a scene, you know, and then the other person will look at it and maybe adjust it or change it or something like that. But it's all in the context of this ongoing conversation.
Well, it's been so much fun talking with you both. Congratulations
likewise,
on the new
Terry.
Film, and thank you so much for coming back to Fresh Air.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having us.
Joel and Ethan Coen, speaking with Terry Gross last Tuesday. The Coen brothers wrote and directed the new film Inside Llewyn Davis. You can hear the full interview on our website, freshair.npr.org.
The Channel 4 News Team, with 7-time Emmy Award-winning anchorman Ron Burgundy.
I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
That was Ron Burgundy in the 2004 film Anchorman, set in the 1970s. In the new sequel, Anchorman 2, set in 1980, Burgundy moves on from San Diego's Channel 4 news team to America's first cable news network. Our next guests are Will Ferrell, who stars as the terrifically vain and shallow Ron Burgundy, and Adam McKay, who directed both Anchorman films and co-wrote them with Ferrell. Ferrell and McKay started working together on Saturday Night Live. They also collaborated on the films Talladega Nights, The Other Guys, Step Brothers, and The Campaign, and they co-founded the website Funny or Die. Terry spoke with them last Thursday and began with a scene from Anchorman 2. After losing his news job, Ron Burgundy gets a job offer from a TV news producer at the fledgling cable channel GNN, the Global News Network. The producer is played by Dylan Baker. Here they are, talking at a diner.
Mr. Burgundy, we're starting a 24-hour news channel. First of its kind, GNN.
That is without a doubt the dumbest thing I've ever heard. You mean news going 24 hours around the clock? A channel that's never off, in other words.
Yeah. Just 24 hours. It's a...
No offense, but you are stupid.
I assure you, we are 100% for real. We've got state-of-the-art facilities in Manhattan.
Yeah.
This is your first week's salary.
By the hymen of Olivia Newton-John!
What do you say, Ron?
I'll take the job. And I swear I'll be number one again. I'm going to do what God put Ron Burgundy on this earth to do. Have salon-quality hair and read the news.
Will Ferrell, Adam McKay, congratulations on Anchorman 2 and welcome back to Fresh Air. Thanks so much for coming. I really enjoyed the film. That's such a great clip. I mean, you get an Olivia Newton-John joke right off the bat there. And how did you decide to do a sequel?
God, we've for years never even thought about doing a sequel, and people kept asking us. And rather than it getting quieter, it actually got louder. Until about 5 or 6 years after the first movie, Will and I finally said, hey, could we actually pull off a sequel?
Mm-hmm.
And then from that point, it took another 3 years to get the budget together and do all that stuff. But yeah, this was really a movie, the sequel that fans asked for.
Yeah, it's, you know, what's so funny about the original movie was that it literally, you know, had a modest opening. It was a modest hit, but it just kept growing in popularity through DVD and cable to the point where we just couldn't ignore the fans, and we thought, why should we? This will be fun.
So it's no longer set at a local station at the news desk. It's, you know, the first global news network,
mm-hmm.
kind of like
yes.
CNN.
Right.
And is that in part because very few people watch the local news anymore unless there's a big weather event? No offense to anyone in local news.
Well, we felt like we needed to jack up the stakes for Mr. Ron Burgundy and his news team. And it was just perfect timing that in 79, 80, that's when you saw, you know, 24-hour news come about. You saw ESPN, MTV, the whole broadcast media world completely changed. And anytime you say the word change, that's a fun world to throw Ron Burgundy into because you know he's not going to handle change well.
So you make Ron Burgundy responsible for some of the worst excesses of cable news. did you spend a lot of time watching cable news so you could really kind of, you know, feel it when you were writing the script?
I think it just when we discovered that we were going to land in the belly of 24-hour news when it was created, your next thought is, oh, this is when everything changed. And this is when you started seeing the stories about the babies in the wells and the Pee Wee Herman in mm-hmm. the porn booth. And, oh, this is when it all turned really kind of into infotainment. And the idea of making that all Ron Burgundy's fault really made us laugh.
So let's hear another clip from the film. And this is... this is a scene where Ron Burgundy and his team are at a meeting with Dylan Baker. Dylan Baker plays the producer from the Global News Network, who's bringing the team into the network, and they're talking about what their show should be. And their show is like the 2 a.m. shift. It's the shift like nobody watches. So here's the meeting.
Let's see here. Global temperatures rise half a degree. Alarm climate scientists. Boring.
What if we show a porno instead of the news?
Freddie?
No, absolutely not.
Freddie, come on. We're just brainstorming here. We're trying to figure out how to make the news less boring, and you act like we peed in your milkshake.
The news is supposed to be boring, Ron. Serious stuff.
I just don't know why we have to tell the people what they need to hear. Why can't we just tell them what they want to hear?
Wait. Say that again?
I said, why do we have to tell the people what they need to hear? Why can't we just tell them what they want to hear?
And what do they want to hear, Ron?
That we live in the greatest country God ever created.
Damn straight!
I love that music, Adam, you have underneath it.
That music's perfect.
I love that it's heroic that he discovers pandering.
So, Will Ferrell, when you first started to, you know, take on the character of Ron Burgundy, talk a little bit about how you saw him and what you did physically and cosmetically to become him.
Well, I've kind of brought Ron out on occasion over the years for charity events, and there was a comedy tour we did where we went to 8 or 9 colleges, and halfway through the show, Ron would come out and interview either the dean of the school or the head football coach, which was always a big hit. And it reminded Adam and I that, oh, it's it's fun to hear this guy interact with people, and it didn't feel dated, it didn't feel old. So I'd kind of had some practice with him, but in terms of once we started filming again for this, it really once I start growing the mustache, you put the wig on, you start wearing the clothes, I end up standing a certain way because Ron Burgundy is so rigid and moves like slightly robotic. I find myself holding my shoulders and neck in a certain way because he's I don't know. He's someone who's, even though he's very confident in a way, he's still wildly insecure and not comfortable in his own skin. and so all those things, you know, I kind of pool together and then he's back and we go from there.
So the mustache is real.
Yeah. The mustache is real, even though people think it looks fake. The mustache, people think the hair looks real, but that's a wig. And they think the mustache looks fake, but the mustache is actually real.
When you're in the middle of shooting the film and you have to have that mustache, what's it like in the periods when you're not on set, but you still are stuck with that mustache?
There is a lot of maintenance when it comes to facial hair. it gets in the way of eating. My children kept asking me, when was the movie over so you can shave your scratchy face? It's an encumbrance to a lot of things. So I have a lot of respect for those who lived in the 1800s when facial hair was mandatory. But you know, it's fun. It makes the character and it's such a vestige of television news from the 70s, and now you hardly see it. So it's a very distinctive thing. But the funny thing is, after looking at yourself in the mirror for 3 months with a mustache, when you shave it, there is a moment for about 24-hour period where you think you look better with the mustache. You're not used to looking at your upper lip at all, and you think it looks misshapen and bizarre and then. Yeah, so it takes about 24 hours to get used to seeing your lip again.
Kind of mustache Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah.
Your movies managed to have, the Anchorman movies managed to have, like, the worst soundtracks ever in terms of the songs. Like, if you asked me to choose songs I really hated from the era, we'd come up with the soundtrack. And I was wondering if that was your approach. I mean, and I'm thinking here of songs like Hold Your Head Up by Argent and I'd Love to See You Tonight, England Dan, and John Ford Coley, Lady.
It's a beautiful song.
A beautiful song, yes.
I don't get your point. I mean, these are lovely, lovely songs
that have stood the test of time.
Yeah. We do a mix. It's actually a crazy process. We have like 300-400 songs that we're constantly cycling through. And what we want the end sort of result to be is that half the songs are secretly enjoyable and half are just horrible. And so something like Ride Like the Wind by Christopher Cross is a really catchy song. Like, we were surprised when we started mm-hmm. playing it. And then you're right, a song like Lady or Muskrat Love, you would probably turn the radio station if you were in your car. So it ends up being this blend.
But I think at the same time, though, we hear from a lot of people, oh, I loved the music. I think there's some kitsch value to all of it that touches a nerve with the audience, where they're guiltily tapping their toe, or you know, and thinking, oh, God, that song is bad, but I kind of love it.
Okay, well, you mentioned Ride Like the Wind, and on the soundtrack album, not in the movie, but on the soundtrack, there's a duet with you, Will Ferrell, and Robin Thicke. That's really funny, so I thought we should hear it. Do you want to say anything about recording this before we hear it?
Well, they had wrangled Robin Thicke to record it, and so he'd already made the recording, and then I, off of what he did, just riffed all these other lines, and Adam wrote some of the spoken word passages. So it was we never actually met each other or saw each other, but but it somehow came out okay.
Did he know what you were going to be doing to his recording?
I don't know. I don't think he did. Yeah. I don't think he did. So, but it's too late now.
Have you heard from him since?
I haven't. I haven't heard.
He called me.
Oh, okay.
He's livid. Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm glad he called you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is Ride Like the Wind from the soundtrack of Anchorman 2 with Robin Thicke and Will Ferrell.
Hey. Hi. Mm-hmm. I like how this is sounding. Hold on, everybody. Here we go. Not quite yet. Pretty soon. Mr. Robin Thicke. Any minute now. All right. Here we go. Take it away.
It is the night. My body's weak.
Sure.
I'm on the run. No time to sleep.
Because you're on the run.
I've got to ride. Ride like a wind.
Right.
To be free again.
We all want that.
And I've got such a long way to go.
Such a long way to go.
To make it to the border. Like the wind, ride like the wind.
You're riding like the wind, for those who don't know.
I was born the son of a lawless man.
You mean Alan Thicke?
Always spoke my mind with a gun in my hand.
That sounds dangerous.
That's Robin Thicke with Will Ferrell doing the commentary from the soundtrack of Anchorman 2, and my guests are Will Ferrell and Adam McKay. They co-wrote the film. Adam McKay directed it. They've been writing partners since their days on Saturday Night Live.
Robin Thicke, the son of Alan Thicke.
Yes.
star of Who's the Boss?
No.
Right?
No.
Growing Pains.
Growing Pains. Pains.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what are your sessions like when you're writing Anchorman? Because, you know, one thing I have to say about both films is that they're really packed with jokes. My impression is you take great pleasure in just making things jam-packed with jokes.
Yeah, it's the funnest part of making these movies is we just love, you know, the ensemble comedy where you don't know where the jokes are coming from. And the idea of like a dense movie that you want to watch over and over again. I think it's from Will and I when we wrote the first Anchorman talked about those old ensemble comedies like Stripes and Animal House and Caddyshack and how no one was doing those anymore. So the idea of having like four funny guys in the lead with Christina Applegate was fun for us. So, yeah, when we write, we're constantly kicking around ideas. And even if it doesn't end up in the script, it'll be something we can remember on the day.
I think when Adam and I were, you know, met on Saturday Night Live and started working together and, you know, it's you're surrounded by writers who have all these rules. And I think, you know, when we decided we would sit down and write a feature one day – we were really rebelling against all these rules that you know, the three-act structure and how you can't do this and this has to be set up in a certain way. And the original Anchorman was, you know, just a kind of a function of wanting to break through all of that. And why can't you have a scene break into an animated sequence? And we just wanted to take, you know, why can't the characters go for a stroll and then all of a sudden get caught in the middle of an epic gang fight between rivaling news teams that is superfluous to the story if you're going to be very strict about it, but at the same time becomes one of the more talked about moments in the movie. And I think we've been governed by that ever since.
So you started promoting Anchorman 2 just at about the moment you signed the contract to do the film. At least it
appears that way.
It appears that way. And so a year ago, you were on Conan O'Brien's show to announce that there was going to be a sequel to Anchorman. And I want to play your appearance on that show.
I actually have an announcement. I want to announce this to everyone here in the Americas, to our friends in Spain, Turkey, and the UK, including England. That as of 0900 Mountain Time, Paramount Pictures and myself, Ronald Joseph Aaron Burgundy, have come to terms on a sequel to Anchorman.
Oh. It is
exciting. It is official. There will be a sequel to Anchorman. There will be a sequel.
Yes.
Gentlemen.
And that was Will Ferrell in character as Ron Burgundy in 2012 on Conan O'Brien's show. So you must enjoy taking the character out into the world, because like you did it on Conan, promoting the movie, you've done it in commercials, which isn't exactly in the world. But, you know, you said before you interview people in character at universities, but you really have to think on your feet to do that.
Yeah, you know, when we had some initial marketing meetings with the studio, I had kind of put it out there that I'd be up for doing some things in character, because it's so much fun to improvise as Ron Burgundy, because he is an expert talker on everything, all subjects, and knows very little about anything. So I can kind of walk into any situation and pretend to know all the facts. So we kind of devised a strategy of various things we do, and it's been a fun way to get the word out about the movie without actually having to talk about it and do
like
the
I'm making you
interviews.
Do right, right. without having to do this
right. But it's I think it's been appreciated, and we've kind of gotten into different pockets of the audience that we never would have reached through Ron's appearances.
So Emerson College changed the name of its communications school for one day and called it, like, I think the Ron Burgundy School of Journalism or of Communications.
Yes, Communications, which Ron, much to Ron's chagrin, he thought it was a lifetime. It was
a lifetime honor, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, just for one day.
But does it make you feel a little bit awkward to ask a university to do something like that to help promote a movie?
No, not one bit. I mean, they're the ones saying yes, and if everyone said no, then you just wouldn't do it. That was another very ironic moment that, you know, we did a 45-minute press conference. It's a fictional character, and there were up to 100 media requests in the Boston area, and it's just fascinating. And there, you know, there I sat in between the president of the university and the dean of the School of Journalism, and they weren't asked one question. All the questions were were posed to Ron Burgundy. And here we are poking fun at media, and yet media can't get enough of what we're doing. So it's very ironic.
Of course, nobody thinks of themselves as a Ron Burgundy type. It's always like the other guy.
Right.
So has anybody ever come up to you and said, that's me, like you really captured me?
I think we get it all the time, especially local news. Everyone will bring someone up from the past and say, was that based on this person? I was actually approached by a newscaster in Los Angeles, a guy by the name of Harold Green, who went from San Diego to L.A. and back to San Diego, and he actually had a mustache. And he stopped me on the street once in Beverly Hills and said, hey, Will Ferrell. I'm like, yeah, hey, Harold Green, because I had remembered him. And he said, hey, I love that movie Anchorman. I got to ask you. Is that based on me? And I just started laughing. I said, no, it's actually, it really isn't. It's kind of an amalgamation of all of you guys. And he said, there's an old saying in the news game. Yeah, right. And he walked away. So he's convinced that Ron Burgundy's based on him.
What other kind of stories do you hear from news anchors?
Yeah, when we went into making the first movie, we did interviews with a bunch of legendary anchors like Larry Kane in Philadelphia. And we met a guy named Jack White, who was based out of San Diego. And we would talk to him, and we were always amazed how the stories they would tell us were actually crazier than what we had
in the movie. Yeah.
Like, he told us a story about his news director getting into a big argument with the producer, going down to the bar on the, you know, ground floor and getting really drunk. And finally, the producer saying, look, you got to come back up here. We're about to go on the air. We need you to direct the broadcast. And the director just said, give me the phone from the bar, made the bartender turn the TV to his news station, and drunkenly directed the news from the bar, calling the shots out into the phone.
And
that doesn't
Jack
even
White
make
said,
sense. I mean,
Jack White said it was a great broadcast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All the stories end with, you know what? hell of a broadcast.
Yeah, he had the news on the TV live, and he was on the phone saying, go to camera two, cut to this, cut to that, and somehow pulled that off.
So how did you come up with the catchphrase, stay classy, which has really caught on? You know, it's caught on. It entered the vocabulary.
I think we were just searching for, you know, you watch news and on a local level and, you know, everyone had their sign-off line. And we were just searching for something so benign that literally meant nothing. And stay classy just stuck with us. I don't even know what it's trying to articulate.
I always think it's funny. The word classy is so not a classy word. The second you're saying you've put a Y at the end of class, you're immediately not classy.
So, yeah, Ron asking his viewers to stay classy. Yeah,
ridiculous.
It has nothing to do with news. It has nothing to – I mean, how are you supposed to even pretend to do that? We don't know, but it obviously stuck.
Well, his new catchphrase is, have an American night?
Don't just have a great night. Have an American night.
Yeah.
And what were you thinking of when you wrote that?
I think it says it all in the phrase, don't just have a great night, have an American night. You may be thinking about having a great night, but you know what's better than a great night? An American night.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. It's always fun to have you on the show, and congratulations on Anchorman 2. Thank you, and happy holidays.
Thanks, Terry. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Terry. Always a pleasure.
Will Ferrell and Adam McKay speaking with Terry Gross last Thursday. Ferrell stars in Anchorman 2. Adam McKay directed both Anchorman films and co-wrote them with Ferrell. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sherrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.B. Nesper is our assistant producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.